Hello, thank you so much for watching and listening. Very short intro today because I'm just really, really excited to jump into talking to today's guest. As you all know from tuning in, today I have the truly incredible Anne Majette with me, who is so influential and has such a wonderful legacy within classical music, and really, I think, has a wonderful grasp on what is going on in the sector behind the scenes as well as on stage as well. So Anne, thank you so, so much for being here today. Really appreciated.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. We were just saying it's general chaos and everyone's a bit dishevelled and there are no rules anymore. So how's things going for you in lockdown in general with just this utter chaos?
Well, it's a bizarre time, and it's a bizarre time for me because, as you know, I quit my job as a music critic in November. And so I was prepared for this spring to be this major retrenchment, reorientation of my own life and me vis-a-vis the classical music world. I just didn't expect the entire world to be having to go through it as well. So I feel a little guilty to have dragged everybody along with me.
You're leading the pack.
Exactly. I would also say that I quit largely to write my book and have more time with my family. Now, definitely the more time with my family is happening, but when you have a child home 24 hours a day, you're trying to keep him oriented. The writing the book has not jumped in, just because, as we all know, those of us with children, the hours in the day dealing with homeschooling and an eight-year-old bouncing off the walls are intense. But I've also been watching heartbroken what's happening to the classical music world, and I just actually did a piece, which I think is posting next week for a publication for VanityFair.com, on how the shutdown is going, as far as one can say it's going for classical music organizations.
Yeah, very much so. It certainly is quite a traumatic time, so, which I'm sure we're going to have lots and lots to talk about. One thing I've been doing with guests so far is, instead of me trying to introduce and failing miserably, is what I'm going to frame as something more interesting, but it's just to cover my bad introducing skills, is to ask you to define yourself and what it is that you do. And you've just mentioned you've gone through a transition, but what has your career been and who are you during this current time?
I have for more than 20 years been a classical music critic. I began as a more general arts critic. My most recent post was chief classical music critic of the Washington Post, a post I had for 11 years, which was a really wonderful opportunity to get to sort of guide coverage for a major paper. Before that, I was at the New York Times. Before that, I lived in Germany, where I began my career as sort of a ragtag freelance arts critic, travel writer. And I really credit those years in Germany to giving me my perspective and my start in my career, and an amazingly fun start to a career because I traveled all over Europe doing whatever I wanted, which is always good. Not something that's so possible from America, where music criticism is of necessity more parochial because there's not a lot of money to go jetting around the world and the distances are farther, so you can't even travel to other cities as easily for premieres. So you end up sort of covering your own city, which is another reason that classical music is in a different position in America. Anyway, I quit that job after 11 years. I felt like I had sort of come to the end of what I was going to be able to do as a critic. I felt like I didn't want to risk repeating myself or continually reinventing myself sort of smaller and smaller. We all know the position of classical music in the larger media is different now. And I've always wanted to write a book I've written several books, but I've always wanted to write my own book. So I quit to write my book and hit the shutdown. But still, the book is still happening. And the book is about music and women in music. It's a historical novel based on Nanette Streicher, the woman who built pianos for Beethoven. And she's completely true, and not enough people know about her, and those who do would welcome a book, but I see it as a way to sort of reach a wider audience for classical music while putting women back sort of at the center of the classical period in Vienna, which is where she lived and worked.
Incredible. Yeah, I think you're doing very well to get a very in-depth career into such a small, succinct little phrase there, which is quite a huge transition. And also just when you were talking, saying, I used to go across Europe and do various things, and I'm just reminiscing about travel about a month ago and being able to go places, which is obviously big change now. So with a lot of my guests, I've talked about how things have changed in the music world. And I think one thing that I haven't really engaged with or started to discover is how it's affecting critics. Because obviously it's not just affecting the performers, but also those who go and do reviews of concerts or engage in music journalism. There's an impact on them. How do you think it's affecting their work at the moment?
I mean, I can anecdotally, my poor successor, the Post did hire a successor for me, still has a full-time classical music critic. He began on a Monday, which was the whole day of HR, you know, meetings. Tuesday was his birthday, and Wednesday they send everybody home for the lockdown. And this is his beginning as a music critic. Wow. And so he has not been able to review a single concert yet. And he tweeted very musically. He said, I'm absolutely sure that whatever concert I first review is going to be the greatest thing I ever heard. Drought. He has a really interesting and challenging job. And, you know, for me, it's one thing because I was established in that job. So I have built up the contacts and the perspective, but he was, you know, coming in, he's building it up new, and he's done quite a few good pieces. I mean, he's not just sitting there idly, but yes, it's funny. I mean, one approach to the shutdown now, of course, is to just write about record reviews. And there's a certain ever dwindling segment of the classical music public that will happily just sit and discuss recordings for hours. And I think if I were still in that job, I would have done a number of pieces on, you know, just escape pieces on Beethoven, or, you know, here's the Beethoven year, let's talk about Beethoven, or music I turn to in times of trouble, or whatever, that kind of thing. It's a great opportunity to catch up on composers you don't know and listening you haven't done. For criticism in a larger sense, it's going to be a really interesting time, because I've always believed that a critic benefits the field best by tough love, and that it's important to call out mediocre performances, because if you try to overpraise a mediocre performance and draw a public to it that then is taught to believe a mediocre performance is a good performance, they will simply turn off classical music. If you go to a meh performance and say, oh, the review says that was very good, I guess I don't like classical music. Whereas if you go to a meh performance and the reviewer says that was really pretty meh, you think, hey, I have pretty good judgment. Maybe I'll try it again. That's simplistic, but I think anecdotally it works. Now, of course, when you're recovering from a time of horrible crisis, the picture really changes. I don't think anybody's going to want tough love for a while. I had a little taste of this after 9/11. I lived in New York City on September 11th, 2001, and I was writing for the New York Times. And the mantra then was try to get back to normal as soon as possible. And I just thought, how on earth can you write a negative review? And it happened that the first concert I went to cover was one I really didn't like. and I just thought, this is not a time for negativity. And there is one review the City Opera went on. The second concert I reviewed was New York City Opera's Magic Flute. And they hadn't had rehearsal time because it had all been wiped out. Their dress rehearsal had been wiped out. And they asked for understanding. And I thought that review was written with just pure love and as reviews should be in a time of crisis. The problem is this crisis is going to go on for years. I mean, who knows how long the results of all this are going to last. And so it's going to be tricky to be a critic. I mean, at least there'll be a lot of hand-holding and love. But I think all you're going to want to do for a long time is say how great that everybody's back, who is back. You know, people are going to have quit their jobs. It's going to be a really interesting time for the field. And I'll have plenty to say in some format or other, whether it's for the Washington Post or not.
Very much so. And I think you touched on something really fascinating in part of that, which was your role or the purpose of a critic. And it was to help audiences inform if they what their view and if it aligns to various parts of the performance. As someone who was a cellist and a performer, I had a sort of a love-hate relationship with the concept of critics and didn't quite understand, especially as a student, what their purpose was. So what is the purpose of a critic, and how do they benefit both the artists and the wider sector as a whole?
Well, you know, I grew up in a family of artists. And so I never read criticism growing up because I thought critics were horrible. That's, you know, they were terrible people. And I used to say resolutely, even when I began this career, I said, I'll never be a critic. And I remember one of my mentors was saying, you should think about it. I'm like, no, I won't do that. I won't turn on the artist. Critics are bad people who attack artists. And of course, artists are going to see it that way. It was that very mentor and other people I met when I realized that criticism is actually a way of engaging with the art form you love. It's a way of deepening your engagement with it. It's a way of moving your engagement beyond just, hey, that was pretty good. And not only your engagement, but people's engagement. I believe, you know, after years of doing it, one of a critic's main functions, especially in the age of social media, is to be a watering hole or a gathering place for opinions. It is not my job to make anybody think the way I think. It's my job to make you think the way you think and maybe argue with me, maybe honing your argumentative skills against what I wrote is the way that I activate what you think. Because the ultimate goal for all of us, artists, critics, whatever, is to get an engaged audience. And so often, especially with classical music, the audience is very timorous and is sort of like, oh, it was great, but I could never do what you do as a critic. I've been going for 30 years to the concerts, but I just don't know much about classical music. And my line has always been, if you went to the movies every Thursday night for 30 years and said you didn't know about film, people would laugh at you. And my other standard answer is, if you tried, you could do what I do. You, as a 75-year-old person who's been going to opera concerts for 30 years, if you had to sit down and write about it, you could. And my favorite anecdote about this is that one person took me up on this challenge and began writing me every Friday morning with his own review of the concert the night before. Wow. And he did this for years, and it was really wonderful. And we became friends, and of course I've retired and we're still in touch, and you know, after all that. But he used to say at the end of every season, he would write a summing up, and he'd say, I've never enjoyed my subscription more. And I found that very poignant, because I wasn't even always answering him. I couldn't answer his reviews every Friday. It was just something he began doing. And through that engagement, he deepened his own enjoyment. It's accessible to every member of the audience, but so few people feel empowered to do it. And so if, as a critic, by making you hate what I write so much that I empower you to write a passionate response, then my job. You know, it's not, but it's certainly not about ordering you to think the way I think, which is, I think, a misapprehension. People think that either I'm telling you you must think what I think, or that I'm acting as a consumer guide to tell you what to buy tickets for. And neither of those is the case. It's also something like a sports writer. Like, you want a document in the media that this happened. You know, you want to write about the games. You want to know what the football match was about. And if you don't write about it, there's not the same record of it. And you say, as a young cellist, you wondered what the purpose was, but I know that people begin to scream when there aren't any reviews. That feels really bad, too, and this feels like nobody took any notice in the world of what you did. And this is, of course, something that's redeveloping itself as newspapers change and modify. We all know that newspaper critics are not going to go on forever, and the internet has come up with ways of doing it, organizations are coming up with ways, and all of this is going to now be accelerated vastly by the aftershocks of what it is we're going through right now.
You're doing an amazing job of leading straight into my questions, which is making my life very easy. So as following on from that, I was going to ask, how do you see the critic's role during this crisis, and what is the future for music criticism? Because I know that for talking to musicians and organisations at the moment, everyone is currently reassessing what they can do and what their role and purpose is at the moment, and then imagining what they can do when this is all over and done with. How do you see that affecting music critics?
Well, you know, the profession of music criticism as a whole has become very hidebound. There's become kind of a template of what you do, and there's become kind of a conservative viewpoint that, you know, the traditions are the best, and classical music tends to be very wedded to its traditions anyway. It was only in the last the longer I did this job, the more confident I became in it. When you start out as a critic, too, you think there's a bunch of hurdles you have to jump over. You've got to prove yourself. You've got to show that you know you're Beethoven and that you can, you know, talk about opera with the big guys and whatever. And the longer I was in it, the more I came to realize this field is incredibly, you know, racist, sexist, white, all these things, and that it is actually, I have the power and the responsibility to speak about that and not simply to go into the old boys club, which is something I tried increasingly to do and was very sort of, I found that revitalized what I was doing. Rather than simply sitting there and writing about the concerts, you write about what could be there. I say all of that because I think that is going to be a part moving forward. Like, it is time to remake the classical music world. The classical music world is going to have to remake itself, and critics can have a role in doing that constructively, not just by sitting there and saying, oh, it's not what we had. I remember that Beethoven performance, which is what everybody who loves classical music tends to do anyway. We all know, you know, that, oh, singers today is not like Caruso, but, or Gerling, or you insert whoever your favorite singer was who was no longer active. So I think it would be really good for the critical profession, especially as younger people are in it, to be talking about what we could become. Could we become less wedded to these huge organizations that suck up millions of dollars to present concerts that are not always that artistically fulfilling or very vital to the culture? Just think what we could do with classical music that is vital to the culture. I don't believe that's too Pollyanna-ish, because I think the music itself speaks to many more people than the classical music world speaks to. I think that people respond greatly to Bach and Bartok and have curious ears, and people are very sophisticated listeners right now. But we have managed to make ourselves believe that the classical music experience is equivalent to going and sitting in a big concert hall with red velvet seats and hearing this concert. Now we're going to have to find ways that aren't that, because it's going to be a while until we want to go sit with 2,000 senior citizens, most of them coughing, which is what the classical music audience has been for quite a while. So wouldn't it be great if we can find ways to excite people who are really eager to be excited by this music, but haven't liked the customer experience we've made of it. I think it's been very short-sighted of institutions to remain so wedded to that experience and to be so slow to branch out and try new things. Now that's going to be the name of the game. And critics can describe it, can give the kind of call to arms I just gave, can do more thoughtful pieces without maybe slamming every attempt. One thing we're going to have to be really careful of in the aftermath of this is allowing for creativity and failure and falling on your face without sort of taking everyone to task. And critics, alas, are a little bit too used to sort of jumping gleefully on something that didn't work. And we're going to have to be gentler about sort of shrugging off things that don't work and encouraging things that do.
Very much so. And I think it could be a very nice moment for reflection for everyone to understand the industry more. And from saying as a young cellist that I always thought critics were there to criticize rather than it being a useful element. I think that's for me not having a connection to critics. And while I was studying, no one ever came in and talked about what critics were or how they did their job or what their purpose was. And at the same time, also with careers, how to plan concerts, the bigger, wider industry as a whole. So this could be a fantastic time for us actually to understand more about what our sector is, in addition to the things you just said.
I would interject too, for a young artist, it's important to remember, and it's not remembered enough, I, as a critic, am not writing for you. Like, the artist always feels so attacked, but I'm writing for my 5,000 readers over there who are buying the tickets. And so it's horrible because the artists are reading it so intently, and you get very wounded, and I get into long dialogues with artists, and I have to keep saying, don't read it. It sounds disingenuous. Of course you're going to read it. But the purpose of it is talking to, you know, the sports fan out there and not to the football player on the pitch. And that's a tricky thing, since most of the avid readers of it are actually in the business. And yet I'm desperately trying as a critic to develop a readership that's not in the business, to bring in new people if possible, you know?
Definitely. Well, before we get into talking about the future and what that could potentially hold, one massive significant part of your recent career was tackling the big issues such as sexism, racism, and in particular sexual assaults and harassment within the industry. You've been very key in investigating figures as part of the Me Too movement and that side of things. What has your journey been with the Me Too investigations? So I know that there's almost some very good timing as to when your obviously interest started and actually the Me Too movement as a whole began.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously it's something that one thought about, the whole James Levine issue, where, you know, one had heard the rumors, one believed the rumors, and as a journalist asked oneself, how would one write about this? And, you know, years ago I had conversations about this, realizing that it was going to be impossible to really get anything on the record. I mean, James Levine, still we don't know what happened in the Metropolitan Opera. Nobody has quite gotten the James Levine story. We've gotten little pieces of his early history, but, you know, so whatever. Anyway, so I was a reasonably aware person, and then the Me Too movement began, and the James Levine article came out, and somebody called me and said, I need to talk to you. I'm going to come up to you at intermission and talk to you. And I'm like, well, sure, I'll talk to you at intermission. And he came up, it was somebody in the business, and he said, are you writing about Me Too? And in classical music. And I said, well, no. I said, you know, I'm a music critic. I'm not really equipped to do an investigative piece on the Me Too movement. I can try to hook you up with an investigative journalist who could maybe do this. He said, no. He said, you need to do it. People will talk to you. They trust you. And this is somebody, I'd never met this person. He was in the industry. I mean, he was a name, but I didn't even know his name. I reviewed him once, like a million years ago. Now you know it's a him. So I said, well, you know, if you have stories that people can tell me, I will listen to some stories and I'll try to hook you up with the right journalist. And from there, the floodgates opened. Somehow this led to my name and address being put out on social media saying, call Anne Majette, here's her number, here's her email, she will listen to your stories. And I'm a strong believer in sort of letting social media do its thing. Like, I try not to interfere too much. I try not to block or control the dialogue, because you can't control it anyway. And I looked at this and I thought, well, I didn't put this out there, but I'm not going to stop it. I was curious to see what would happen. And I thought, as soon as I step in and say, that's true, that's not true, I've changed it somehow. I've changed the dynamic. So I just let it stay out there, and I began getting calls. And I was not prepared for the calls I began getting. I mean, it was people who hadn't talked ever before and who were telling me about rapes and about, you know, assaults and about things they lived with for ages. These became long conversations of an hour, 2 hours, tears. I didn't have the training particularly, but I just thought, okay, as a human being at that point, you just have to listen and try to be a good person and try to do what you can, again, as a human being, to work with it. And it was obvious that there was some kind of story there. And trying to figure out what that story was a challenge. So, I mean, I talked to 55, it was maybe more actual victims. I talked to some 75 people. Some of them were like, this happened to my friend. But it was 55 people who actually had something happen to them. And then you're trying to figure out, well, is it going to be a story where you bring down somebody? Is it going to be a story? And I really didn't want to just focus on the big names or the people. I knew some other stories were in the works, and I didn't want to, like, try to. It was one of those rare times when you don't really want to compete with somebody else who has a lead on you. You want to do what you can do as the most good. And those of us who were working on it actually developed a kind of behind the scenes camaraderie, which is unheard of in an investigative piece, but it was so hard to get stuff on the record that you could actually print. So we, you know, we focused on the people where we had the most mentions and thought we could get the most, but also tell a story of how pervasive this is. Because for me, the horrible part of the story is that some of the people who do the most harm are not the famous ones, but the people who were like composition teachers in some Midwestern university who damage generations of women in ways that nobody is able to expose, because no newspaper is going to shock any reader by bringing this out, and get slapped on the wrist repeatedly by school administrations. I hope that's starting to change. Anyway, so we tried to do a piece. I teamed up finally with an investigative reporter, because as a critic, it's way beyond my experience. I mean, just going through those levels of lawyers, I had written many, many feature reviews and feature stories and reported stories, and I thought I was a pro at it, but this was a different level, obviously. So I teamed up with Peggy McGlone, who's wonderfully experienced as a reporter, and we wrote this story together, and it did attempt to be a sort of global picture of what was happening. We focused on three names of people, including the conductor Daniele Gatti, and William Prussell, the concertmaster of the Cleveland Orchestra, and Bernard Uzan, a freelance opera director. All three of these people were well known. There were many, many, many stories, and even so, it was touch and go about getting each one into print. We also had wanted to write about David Daniels, and we didn't have enough sources on the record. I can say that openly now, because David Daniels is on trial in Houston for rape, and he has been dismissed and disgraced from the University of Michigan, and he's got a lawsuit going on in Michigan. There are multiple issues with David Daniels, so that story finally did get out. But our story came out and had a much bigger effect than I thought it would have, given how much stuff we knew that we couldn't put in the story because we didn't have it on the record. I would really like to encourage everybody hearing this to understand that when something gets into a major paper, it has gone through so many levels of lawyers and proof. You were reading the tip of the iceberg of what happened. And then promptly everybody says, this is unsubstantiated, the word of some woman survived. And it's like, believe me, it's substantiated. It's deeply substantiated. I mean, that's not true of the tabloids, obviously, and that muddies the issue, and everybody is so mistrustful of the press right now. But these stories are very deeply researched. When you read that 25 women came out against Plácido Domingo, you better believe that something happened, that a lot of things happened. Anyway, so that's the genesis, since you asked, of that story. And because it had a big impact, and I think because it didn't just focus on somebody, but sort of did anchor it in the whole classical music industry, it had a very gratifying impact. And I was a little thwarted in not being able to follow it up more, because the appetite for Me Too stories and classical music stories, it became a real minefield in newsrooms, because every field then had dozens of them. So we had the restaurant Me Too story, and we had named the field, and there was one, and we had to get in the queue, and it was very hard to sort of get space for it. And I don't know how much really changes. I knew when the Domingo story finally did come out, that was going to be a big thing, and it has been. And now this current crisis has sort of, you know, covered over that. All three of the people we wrote about who lost their jobs are more or less back in various ways, or at least got big settlements in the end. It's very dispiriting to see how much the system is set up to just perpetuate the protection of its own, regardless of what they may have done. And people ask me the reasons I left my job. Certainly, one thing that made it easy to leave my job is that I knew about a lot of people I wasn't able to name. And going blithely along and not being able to name people and then having to face countless times, are you going to review this person? Are you not going to review this person? You can't name names without all of the proof that I had been through. But so you can't say I'm not going to review you because that already becomes sort of libelous. I'm very, very glad to be out of that position and hopeful that more people get named, you know?
Certainly, and I can imagine it's an incredibly difficult position to put you in when obviously then that has to, for example, not just do reviews but potentially interviews that are in, sort of in close proximity to people like this, and it must be the actual sort of human strain it will take on you, it must be quite large, and especially listening to victims' stories as well. Did you receive any supports in dealing with issues? Because I know that if you work in the mental health industry, there's lots of safeguarding things in place to help support key workers involved in domestic abuse and violence and sexual assaults, etc.
No, we got some really good tips from the people who had done the Me Too story for the restaurant, in the restaurant world. They had some advice about just talking to people and saying, do you have somebody you can call when you get off the phone with me, and that kind of thing. But I did have to take some breaks for my own mental health just because it was so intense. And because each story then, I mean, as a journalist, there's no way to have objectivity. And some people can, like, this is who I am, I guess. And I hadn't been set up to do this kind of interview work, but I really took it to heart, you know. And I called it for a while, Oh No, Not You Too, because I realized that virtually every male musician who I thought was friendly with and who contacted me wanted to get together for lunch. I mean, which is normal. You contact the critic and you have lunch, or you know, email or whatever. I gradually realized that every one of them who contacted me during that time was trying to find out what I knew about him. it was really, really disillusioning. And people I thought of, you know, and you discover like, oh, they think that we're very friendly because they want me not to know what they have done. And eventually I found out about all of them. And it was, you know, and you know, anybody watching who wonders if this means him, yes, it does mean you.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, it must have been such a surreal time to go through, and imagine something that accelerated very, very quickly. You mentioned obviously that we've made progress, and that you're hoping that not just the big names obviously have repercussions, but the smaller ones that may not be investigated by large-scale journalists. Do you think we're finished on this journey of tackling sexual abuse, or are we still in the blocks and we've got a long way to go?
We're in the blocks. And of course, it's not just classical music. As we know, we're seeing it in every industry, and every industry is wondering, you know, when is it okay to come back? When have you redeemed yourself enough? You know, politics, entertainment. I would like to think, I mean, some of the important work that's been done, there's one undergraduate student at the University of Michigan who's done two major pieces uncovering professors. And the University of Michigan has had to have a real revisiting finally. I mean, enough lawsuits against professors. You have to really think about this stuff. So I hope that it's creating sort of a snowball effect. But it will take time, and it's slow. And it's certainly not only the older generation that does this kind of thing. There are young people who are accused of it. There's two New York Philharmonic players who were booted for Me Too related. It was supposed to be a sexual assault on a colleague whom they drugged, and now they've been reinstated because the claim was overturned on the basis of an investigation. And it's very tricky because the union, and maybe this is true in England as well, but the union in America represents all musicians. That means the perpetrators as well as the victims. So a bunch of these perpetrators, once the victims managed to get them kicked out, then the union went back in on the side of the perpetrators to try to get them settlements because they had to stick up for them. And that's really unsavory and unpleasant and unfortunate. And it's led to things like, I mean, the New York Philharmonic thing, I haven't researched. I don't know any of the background, so I won't say any allegations against anybody on either side. But it's an unfortunate picture.
Very much so. And I think in the UK we're slightly lucky as well, because we don't have the statute of limitations in the same way as in the US. So for anything that's historic, we are still able to go through and tackle that legally, not just from an organisational standpoint.
What you're doing at some of the music schools, right? We're seeing these big school reckonings. I was going to go into some of that, because Ian Pace, the pianist, right? And he's been keeping tabs on all of the student sexual abuse cases in England for years, and he had to take a break from mental health too, because it was all children, and it's horrible. But that was so much another story that my editors finally just said, no, it has to be only America, because if you start doing all of them, you know, there's a whole book written in Germany on sexual assault among students. It's not a pretty picture.
No, very much so. Well, moving on from obviously that incredible groundbreaking work onto what's the current state of music is on a wider scale. What do you see are the main issues facing orchestras during the COVID-19? Because I know that both the US, the UK and Europe have hugely different funding models. So obviously in the US, you've got some different unique systems. Well, yeah. What issues do you think are mainly facing us as an industry as a whole?
Well, in the US, it's, as you say, it's private. So the three main sources of income are private donations, corporate foundation funding, and ticket revenue. All of those are taking a huge hit. I mean, private funding right now is emotionally up, but the stock market is plummeted, and so that's going to be a problem. Corporate and foundation funding is not good, because they're all putting it into making masks, which is important, you know, and obviously the ticket revenue is nil, and is going to be nil for a while. In the larger picture, and I think I alluded to this before, I think it's been a huge problem that the field has been so dominated by these large institutions that have made us think classical music is synonymous with a symphony orchestra, with an opera house. I love symphony orchestras and opera houses. I also love going and sitting in a red velvet chair. And I mean, I like the traditional thing, but I understand a lot of people don't. And I also like not just the traditional thing. I think these institutions have been incredibly slow to move into the 21st century. And a few institutions have done it and shown how it can be done. The Los Angeles Philharmonic has been very forward-looking and managed to sort of keep the tradition going while being exciting to a wider audience, trying different kinds of things, doing lots of new music and commissions. It's all great. And their fundraising has been up. Their ticket sales have been up. So as I said earlier, I think it's going to push some of these big institutions into new ways of thinking. I hope it helps us create new models. It feels horribly mean-spirited to be saying anything at this point, like, well, it would be good if some of the institutions left. That was always going to be very painful. It would be heartbreaking if they close. But the fact remains that classical music is one of the few fields where we expect all these institutions a century or more old to keep going. And if any of them folds, it's a tragedy. And you think about, you know, factories. I've often said we're kind of like, you know, a company trying to make 1947 Cadillacs and trying to convince everybody that what you really need is a 1947 Cadillac. And or a 61 Aston Martin. And you can say, well, those are great cars, but we want modern cars too. And classical music is not really allowed for the development of those modern systems in the same way. And it's really time for an industry that has more contemporary stuff as well as old stuff. You're never going to say that those old cars are not good. You just also want to have new cars. And some of those new cars will be crappy, and you get rid of them. And that's a healthy economy. Classical music has not been healthy for a while. And it's not because of the music. And saying that is not an attack on Bach and Beethoven. And the problem with the discussion is that as soon as you say classical music is in trouble, you get all kinds of emotional responses about how great the music is. And like, that's not the picture. If it was up to Bach and Beethoven and that was enough to feed artists, that would be great. But we have to figure out how to present Bach and Beethoven in the world today, and we have to allow for there to be multiple ways of doing it. The problem is that those big institutions are what have enabled musicians to make a living out of it. And we all know that freelancing is a brutal life. It's a brutal economy. And the prospect of going back to that is going to turn off many people. And many people who are freelancers now are being ruined. You know, there are people sitting home in their apartments that they don't know how to pay for next week, next month, let alone next year, and have no income for the next, you know, until when is it going to be? Fall 21 that people start coming back? Is it going to be January 21? It's open to question. So it's a very painful time. And as a critic, I have to be careful about saying, oh, well, it's going to be great if we could get rid of some of these old institutions, because dozens and dozens of people whose livelihoods are affected and who are thinking, now I'm going to have to go into some other business, will say, how can you be so callous?
Very true.
But I do think that is a part of the reality of what we're looking at.
Very true. And I think, I know in the UK, looking back at how we've weathered various different economic storms and things in the past, orchestras have always been able to go through them. So the last orchestra to go bust in the UK was the Yorkshire Symphony Orchestra, which is where I'm based, so I know a little bit more about it. And that was in 1955. So we've gone through however many recessions, and we've seen big, big department stores and all these legendary organisations, their institutions that have all gone bust, and yet orchestras have always been there and somehow survived. One thing that I'm slightly hopeful for is that one of my thoughts is that we were potentially sleepwalking into disaster, and by the fact that we haven't been forced to innovate or change throughout all this period of time means we're potentially getting to a point of complacency where we would almost fizzle out on an organisation level. And by having this almost flashpoint where we're having to ask ourselves some very deep, important questions is potentially a good thing to make sure we're in a stronger position going forwards. And again, with streaming music being one of the most popular genres or fastest growing genres on for classical music, there's a lot of hope in there on the internet as to how we can potentially grow going forwards, which is really important, I think.
The two hitches with streaming music are, one, how do you monetize it, especially right now when it's all out there free? And two, these institutions have been trying to deal with this for a while, and very few of them have actually been very smart about it. As you have written yourself, there's been notorious sort of dunderheadedness in the classical music establishment how to make effective online marketing. And as a singer recently said to me, a lot of the stuff has been for promotional purposes. And, you know, people have been more effective doing short videos to get audiences interested, but will they be able to come up with things that are the main event? The Met HD broadcasts and some of the Opera House broadcasts from Europe being maybe the exception. And even that has not been the salvation of the field that everybody hoped. It's been very good for the Met, but not for the field as a whole. And the whole wave we saw right after the Met HD broadcast began, every house began jumping in. But that's been curtailed considerably since then because it was cost prohibitive, and also the union contracts made it difficult. We are going to have to see a major retooling of broadcast rights and contracts, and the whole fee system is going to have to be overhauled, which is, again, going to be painful.
Massive. That was my next point, was to ask you if you had any predictions as to what's going forwards. And if you're listening and watching in the UK, something that you may not know about the US system for musicians is the level of contracts that are involved for orchestral players, and they're very complex. And there's obviously the unions are very heavily involved as well, which is great for protecting musicians' rights, but equally they haven't necessarily adapted for the 21st century just yet, I don't think.
It's been very tricky because the musicians' rights thing is wonderful. Musicians should have the right to get paid, but a lot of these contracts came up when recordings were still making a lot of money, and when the Chicago Symphony was upset if they only sold 50,000 copies of something. And as we know today, selling 1,000 copies of something will land you on the Billboard classical charts. It's a very different, you know, media market out there. And those broadcast rights have kept many opera companies have all of their performances archived but can't broadcast them without paying huge amounts to the musicians, and that's a problem. You were asking about predictions, how orchestras will move through this?
For classical music field in general, so the whole sector, what potentially it may look like in 2, 5, 10 years' time, which could be a very profitable question if you can answer it.
The fact that's so amazing is that, first of all, this is something that affects everybody. Like, no musician is performing right now. And second of all, nobody knows. And I mentioned I did this article last week, and I was talking to some industry leaders and plugging back into my, you know, it was nice to touch base again. But, you know, nobody's got a crystal ball to see how we're going to come out of this. A lot of it depends on when audiences can start to come back, who's going to want to come back. Are we going to hit a whole audience of boomers who are like, oh, it's fine, I'll go out? Or is everybody going to be so thoroughly spooked? I mean, you know, the classical audience, as we know, has been aging anyway. It's sort of 75 and up right now. It's a, you know, terribly vulnerable population to COVID-19. And I think most of that generation is being sensible. It's the sort of 70-year-olds who have anecdotally been more cavalier about just rushing out and not taking it so seriously. Now, to assume that the older audience won't go online is also false. We've seen the older audience is quite tech savvy when they want to be. There's not, I mean, with a few exceptions like my mother, but who is not watching for this reason. But you know, people are very good at keeping in touch with their grandchildren. There's been a lot of Zooming with family during this. I think that, you know, that's a potential. But does that stand in for live performance? I'm a terrible watcher of streaming media because it's hard for me to tune out the distractions of my home life. And I'm always like, oh, I can get up and get a drink. And that changes the whole experience of sitting in a room with people. The communal aspect of classical music is one of the things about it that makes it distinctive. And one of the things that's going to be really called into question. I know from talking, I mean, one really interesting note on all this is that this business has become such a grind for so many people, for high level musicians. And I mean, it's a wonderful grind. You love the music, but still you're on this nonstop treadmill. Administrators are so busy just trying to keep their institutions' heads above water that they really haven't had time to think about innovations. Or it's one of the reasons innovation has been so slow, because it takes everybody's energy all the time just to keep the status quo going. And some musicians have said, even publicly, that, you know, as awful as this is, I'm so glad for the break. Oh my God, like, I'm actually getting to rest my voice. I'm actually getting to learn roles. I'm actually getting to get to know my kids. My kids are blossoming. There's been a meme going around among Broadway artists that Broadway is going to come back and everybody's going to be rested, uninjured. Their voices are going to be healthy. It's going to be great. And by the same token, administrators are able to think things through. And I've talked to some administrators who are taking this as oxygen. One who has a smaller company said, you know, he was getting to the point of like just not looking forward to getting out of bed in the morning. And all of a sudden, he's getting to reinvent himself again and retool this. And, you know, nobody wants to sound happy for this misfortune, but it is a huge reflection on our field. And again, this isn't just about the shutdown. I did a piece a couple of years ago on Pierre-Laurent Aimard, the pianist, taking a year off. And he talked about what it was like to take a year off and how amazing it was and how he was scared to come back. And I got so much mail from musicians saying, oh my God, I wanted a year off, and realizing what a difficult, difficult life this is. And you can hope for all of us again, because our modern life has been this kind of treadmill thing. You can hope that maybe some more humanity and slowness will be a part of our routines after this shutdown, that we won't be so quick to go back to this hectic aspect, and that maybe we can revert to a little bit of 1950s-ishness in terms of our interactions, and that will infuse our classical music world with something more, you know, human, exciting, not just the grind.
Very much so. And thinking as well, if, say, for example, travel restrictions on a global level are impacted for the next few years, maybe as much it'd be amazing to see world-class artists in your hometown all the time, actually having more local people be involved, and also the impact that will then have on those people who are traveling nonstop and won't be home for more than a day or a week, a year, and this sort of thing. And that's something that could be a huge benefit to the industry and to the individuals who are involved. And it's great to hear you say.
And then to the art, because all of that reflects the art. I mean, one very funny thing about living in Washington, D.C., the longer I was here, the more I began to realize it, that, you know, the Kennedy Center presents all the big groups that go to Carnegie Hall, often right before or right after Carnegie Hall, because New York and Washington are not far apart. And what that means on a human level, if you are a violinist playing Carnegie Hall, the concert the night before your Carnegie concert is like the rehearsal for the main event, and the concert the night after your Carnegie concert is the letdown. And so Washington was never quite getting, I mean, which is silly, of course, because we've had amazing performances, and sometimes it just happens that Washington gets the good performance. But very often you read about these amazing performances at Carnegie Hall of people who offered slightly tamer repertoire in a slightly less exciting way in Washington. And that's just the way tours are. You get it up for certain stops and you get excited for certain stops. And as you say, it would be really nice to sort of break that up. Of course, tours are economically necessary, because if you're going to go to America, you want to do everything you can. But maybe there's some way that we will vary that, and that people will, you know, do smaller tours. And I know that Washington Performing Arts has said they're, for their comeback, they're planning concerts with local people so that it can be put off or moved around without a huge thing, without it being a huge problem, that, you know, you can reschedule it because the people will still be there. It's not that you have to grab the chance of an artist coming in. And the travel restrictions thing is likely to be very real. I mean, it's going to affect tickets as well, because I think the level of cultural tourism is going to be affected if plane tickets are suddenly more expensive. And again, that's not a bad thing. Look, the city of Venice is possibly like discovering its water again without all the cruise ships going through. And, you know, maybe you'll be able to go to a museum and not be run over by busloads of people who have come to see three works of art following a red umbrella, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, it's I was talking to Amanda McLeod, who's a singer, on Friday, and one of the projects she runs is something called Compose Her, which is a prerogative to try and commission more music by female composers for choir. And we're talking about what programming is going to look like going forwards, and will orchestras or programmers be very conservative and just go for bums on seats repertoire, or which I think they may do, but in reality I think actually the more experimental, going for lesser known composers and contemporary works is what people are going to want to go for. They're going to want that new experience rather than something that's different.
I think it's going to be really conditioned by the concert hall. Like, you can't do a Verdi Requiem. Well, actually, I have seen a Verdi Requiem in a little tiny thing with eight people, so I can't say that. But some of the, you know, the Brahms First Piano Concerto, it's very difficult to do some of these things in a different format. And if you're trying to experiment with different formats, it makes sense to try to experiment with different musics. That said, everybody's going to flock to that first Brahms Requiem, and everybody's going to cry their eyes out, and that will be a wonderful catharsis, and it will reaffirm the meaning of classical music to everyone, and you'll see 20 million editorials on it, and, you know, whatever. That is a part of the music, and in this time of crisis, we already have seen lots of articles about, oh, the balm of music and the healing, and we need art now more than ever to comfort us, as if art was some sort of, you know, security blanket. Yeah. And you know, that's good too. I have cried at my share of Brahms Requiems in my life at times of crisis, including after 9/11. But I think the programming will be strongly influenced by the venue, and I think the more experimental people have to be with how they're presenting music, the more experimental the programming will be as well.
Very much so. Well, as a final thing to leave us with, what is it you've seen during this time that you've it's really made you smile? What online content or various different programs or initiatives that have come out of this crisis that have really touched you, or also you've seen and really enjoyed?
There are definitely a few, and I haven't been watching as much as I would if I didn't have an 8-year-old at home. But the bass baritone Ryan McKinney started a YouTube channel, and he's been putting content out every few days. My attention was drawn to that because he did a Corona Dämmerung, which was a scene from Wagner, and it was actually a straight scene from Wagner's Rheingold with him and Jamie Barton, the mezzo-soprano, and it was done over smartphones. And it's Wotan and Fricka arguing about Valhalla. It's the beginning of Rheingold when they're talking to each other, which is not the most audience-friendly of pieces. But it was hysterical and also wonderful because it was a legitimate staging of it. It wasn't just a parody. And they kept having little text messages popping up from, like, Fossold and Fafner, you know. Where's Fry? Anybody seen Freya lately? Emojis, logo with the fire symbol. And Frick is, like, brushing her teeth, and Wotan is, you know, showing her this Zoom listing for his, or Zillow listing for the castle, the $25 million castle. And it was also really well done, and they were really singing it. And they had an accompanist on the third, Kathleen Kelly was the accompanist on a third Zoom channel. I don't know how they edit this all together. So I loved this so much. I went back and watched all of his channel, and it's all delightful. It's all wonderful. I actually spoke to him about it, and he said that his father was a film director, and he's, you know, he's always had a little bit of this sort of knack, because of course not every artist is up to saying, not every artist feels like performing. Some of them are mourning, some of them want to be in their bed, and there should be no should about you should be out there performing. But that's been a highlight. And then the St. John Passion from Leipzig, from the St. Thomas Church in Leipzig, they put it out on Facebook on Good Friday, and it was a socially distanced version of it. Did you see it? It was amazing. No. They had a tenor soloist taking most of the roles. They had a marimba and a keyboard. It was a harpsichord, I think, or a forte piano, probably harpsichord and organ. She was flipping back and forth. And then they had four singers positioned around the room. And then they had virtual choruses. All the choruses that were going to come to the Bach Festival came in virtually on split screens, from a chorus of four people all dressed up in their tuxes to a chorus of 25 in their street clothes. And they came in to do the different chorales. And it was astonishingly moving and beautifully done. And I think it's reached 350,000 people now. If you go in the Facebook channel, it's really gotten out there. But it's wonderful to see something. And that was the heart of tradition, the St. Thomas Church in Leipzig with the Bach tradition, doing something new with it in a respectful way that even early music aficionados can appreciate. That's sort of the best of what one could do with this.
Massively. Am I right in thinking the Wagner opera was one that you tweeted about, and then the baritone ended up commenting on the lines of, I had very mixed feelings about getting another review from Anne Majette at one point or something?
No, he said, I thought I wouldn't get a review. He was very nice about it.
Oh,
it was
brilliant.
Like, I thought I wasn't going to get reviewed, or I'm so thrilled to get reviewed by Anne Majette again or something. Because he was in the middle of doing Don Giovanni in Washington, and I was supposed to be on a panel about the Don Giovanni like the day after everything shut down, and I hadn't seen it yet, so I missed his Don Giovanni, so I felt extra bad about it. So there was that in the, but I talked to him and said, you see, you haven't escaped me yet.
It is genuinely the most amazing video. I'm gonna definitely check out the Leipzig one, but I've seen this and it is so good.
So, and then they did a Marriage of Figaro, and from with the Houston Grand Opera Studio, that was pretty wonderful.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It really is absolutely amazing to talk to you. If people want to try and find you online and your various bits of writing, both in publications and also on your website and social media, where can they find you?
I have a website at annemajette.com, which has some of my greatest hits put together. You can certainly look on the Washington Post website and the New York Times website, but the annemajette.com, I try to keep updated with latest things. And then I'm very active on social media, so Facebook, Twitter. Come find me. I'm Classical Beat on Twitter and Anne Majette on Facebook.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. And if you've been listening, thank you again so much for being here and for listening along. Next week, guests aren't 100% confirmed yet, but that'll be something I'll be announcing on social media. As always, all the blogs and all the podcasts and things are on david-taylor.org. And I hope you've really enjoyed. You get to laugh now, Anne, because I haven't actually worked out how to end these yet, and they just kind of like ramble and tail off, which is almost becoming a thing in itself, but it's just a fizzle out in effect.
Like from Washington, this is Anne Majette, or I could sing, you know.
We'll go for singing. This could be the start of your new career.
I've already done a performance art video. We have no idea how crazy I will get as this shutdown continues.
Exactly. Sort of day 102 and all of a sudden. Perfect. Well, I'm amazing. Thank you so much. I hope you have a good day, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.